Hello, I'm Guy Foster, and in this week's podcast, I'm going to be speaking to our head of asset allocation, Paul Dannis. We're going to be talking about inflation, which has been the force behind a lot of the market's preferences for different stocks, different sectors over these last few weeks. But bear in mind, we can't guarantee sources from outside Brewin Dolphin. Tax legislation and allowances can change. And remember that when you invest, your capital is at risk. Investment values can increase or decrease because of currency fluctuations. Future performance can differ from that of the past. So are prices going up? And if so, for how long? Find out in just a few moments. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Brewin podcast. With me, Guy Foster, Chief Strategist at Brewin Dolphin, and joined by a regular guest of the podcast, Paul Dannis, who's our Head of Asset Allocation and Macro Strategy. So welcome back to the podcast, Paul.
Thanks, Guy.
I think if we look at what's going on in the market at the moment, I think the phrase that gets used a lot more than others right now is the reflation trade. And it's this idea that if you can see what's happening in terms of inflation, that explains a huge amount in terms of how bonds are performing, in terms of which kind of equities are doing well, which kind of equities are doing badly. And just generally this topic, inflation, that has always been of interest, is of particular interest at the moment. So right now, the market is getting interested, maybe a bit worried even about inflation. And why don't you explain what's behind that?
Okay, well, governments around the world have spent heavily to stabilize their economies. So, and central banks have absorbed a lot of the debt governments issued to fund the stimulus on their own balance sheets. So this is set to continue as US President Joe Biden has proposed another large COVID stimulus bill. And after that, the Democrats plan to pass a large structural package. So the Fed will likely continue to buy the debt issued to fund this spending. So against this backdrop, the expectation is that consumers who've built up lots of savings over the past 10 months will spend big as economies reopen. And the concern is that all this could spark some inflation.
So you think a lot of it's to do with the fiscal stimulus. How much fiscal spending are we actually talking about here?
Well, Biden's proposed another $1.9 trillion in stimulus to combat the COVID fallout and another $10 trillion over the next 10 years of structural spending. This is on things like clean energy, infrastructure, healthcare, et cetera. So the size of the bills that are ultimately signed into law should be significantly smaller than this, as there isn't the appetite in Congress for spending this much money. But the amounts passed will be very big. And higher taxes will pay for some of the increase in spending, but a large portion will likely be funded by higher deficits.
And that's, I guess, one of the things that's driving the demand side of this then. But there are concerns about what's happening with the supply side of the economy, driven by the pandemic. So what's going on there?
Yeah, well, manufacturing delivery times have lengthened as the pandemic has interrupted supply chains, with some sectors hit harder than others. So for example, auto companies have been impacted by semiconductor shortages. There's also been bankruptcies, with lots of small businesses now having closed their doors for good. So this reduces aggregate supply, yes.
And what impact does that then have on inflation?
Well, we should get a spike in inflation in Q2 this year. And a lot of that increase will be down to base effects, as prices will be compared to Q2 last year, which was a time when most places around the world were in full lockdown mode and prices were weak. But beyond that Q2 increase, it's probably too early to expect a serious inflation problem, as there's just too much slack in the economy for that to happen. So in aggregate, there are too many people out of work and too many businesses running below capacity.
Okay, well, I mean, it's always always a bit difficult really to estimate how much slack there truly is in the economy, how many of these people are temporarily and how many are more permanently out of work. So how much slack do you think there really is in the economy?
Yeah, well, it's true that some of the jobs that existed pre-COVID are not coming back. You know, although there'll be increased demand for labor in some sectors, Most former retail workers, for example, are not about to become computer programmers. So the pandemic will also leave scars. And one notable scar is that the long-term unemployed will have a harder time securing work in the future. So because of this, it's likely that the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment, otherwise known as NARU, has risen. And this may imply that there's less slack in the economy than some believe. That said, there's probably still enough spare capacity to prevent inflation from becoming a serious problem for now.
So right at the moment, you do see inflation picking up, but you don't believe it's going to be a problem. So, I mean, what are the risks to that view?
Well, it does seem like the risk appear to be more tilted to the upside than the downside. And I'd start with two main concerns. So the first is central bank financed government deficits. So in the US, for example, government debt to GDP is already back up at an all-time high. The huge fiscal stimulus expected this year will push that ratio substantially higher. And with baby boomers retiring, government spending on healthcare and social security is set to rise significantly. So it'll be politically difficult to reduce these entitlement benefits, and it'll also be politically difficult to raise taxes enough to fully pay for them. So running deficits seem more likely, and the Fed will likely have to continue to finance these deficits via quantitative easing, and central bank finance deficits raises inflation risks. And then the second main concern is linked to globalization. So the two-decade period that began with the fall of the Berlin Wall and the integration of the former Soviet Union states into the global economy saw an unprecedented pace of globalization. So after that, we had the creation of the EU single market in 1992. Then we had the NAFTA deal, which is the biggest trade deal of its time, in 1994. The creation of the WTO itself in 1995. There was the launch of the euro in 1999, and then an expansion of the EU in 2004 to include the Central and Eastern European countries. But China joining the WTO at the end of 2001 was probably the biggest globalization event within those two decades. And the impact globally was quite deflationary and kept developed world manufacturing wages low. So to use a stat to illustrate this, from 1950 to 2001, the wage share of GDP in the US ranged from about 61% to 66%. After China joined the WTO, that wage share GDP plunged to just over 56%, which was the lowest in modern history. So this weak wage growth helped keep a lid on inflation. And now the median voter in the developed world is pushing back on globalization as it's resulted in inequality. So to the extent that the median voter determines elections, we should see more politicians elected who are ready to adopt a more protectionist approach. And just to finish this point, in the US, for example, although Biden should take a less volatile and adversarial approach than Trump, his policies are also expected to be protectionist. So during his campaign, he promised to direct government procurement to American businesses. He promised to bring supply chains back to the US and also to slap tariffs on countries with weak climate protections.
So, I mean, that's really interesting. And another of the points that really often gets cited discussing inflation and the outlook for inflation is demographics or the age structure of society. So how do you see that playing into the outlook for inflation?
Yeah, well, in a 2016 report, BIS researchers found a link between a society's age structure and inflation. So they say that a population that has a high share of people in working age is associated with lower inflation. And this makes sense to the extent that workers are the supply side of the economy and consumers are the demand side. So we consume throughout our life, but only produce in our working years. So a lower share of the population in working age represents less supply relative to demand. And the researchers found that age structure dampened inflation from 1970 to 2010, but is projected to boost inflation out to 2050, as there's projected to be a declining share of workers relative to consumers.
Right. So in the short term, then, we've got kind of fiscal factors and we've got supply side shortages. In the longer term, we've got possibly the end of globalization or reduction of globalization, and then these demographic factors that you're talking about. It's quite a lot of different things impacting the outlook for inflation. Is there anything else that you need to consider?
I think so. I think there's several other developments, and I'd highlight three. So the first is linked to the fact that the median voter in the Anglo-Saxon world seems to be shifting to the left on fiscal matters. So this means that we're likely going to end up with policies that are less friendly to wealthy individuals and corporations and more friendly to workers. So going back to the US, for an example, Biden wants to raise corporate taxes and increase labor market protections. So these policies could reduce businesses' willingness to invest, holding back the supply side of the economy. And meanwhile, less inequality from these policies could also boost aggregate demand. So this dynamic could be somewhat inflationary. And then a second risk is that the Fed has moved its goalposts. So under its new approach, the Fed has told us that it'll tolerate inflation above its target following periods when inflation undershoots its target. Now, given that inflation has been below target for so long, the Fed's currently aiming for above 2% inflation. So on paper, this new framework also calls for higher rates for longer after a period when inflation has been running consistently above the Fed's inflation target. But in practice, it's difficult to see the Fed adhering to this policy. A lot of the time, the Fed is cutting rates when it's in firefighting mode and dealing with the crisis. So it's unlikely the Fed will delay rate cuts in this kind of an environment. So the main motivation for the Fed adopting this new framework that's taken on it is to generate higher inflation, which is a risk to higher inflation itself. And then the final risk, I guess, I'd flag is that for inflation is that central banks at some point are at risk of becoming less independent or even outright losing their independence. And it's unlikely that this will happen anytime soon, but we are seeing fringe theories like modern monetary theory, known as MMT, getting more attention. So MMT essentially takes the independence of central banks away and puts control of the printing press in government hands. MMT proposes that governments increase taxes when necessary to avoid inflation, but it's probably naive to believe that governments would raise taxes sufficiently when inflation does pick up. So MMT is likely to remain just a fringe theory, but the risk is that the next really bad recession could push fringe theories like this a bit closer to the mainstream, which would have inflationary implications.
Okay, so I mean, one of the things that you referred to earlier was the degree of slack, labor market slack in the economy. And I guess looking further forwards, one of the reasons why a lot of people refuse to be concerned about inflation is because of the potential for there to be a lot more slack driven by automation, robotics, AI, resulting in massive job losses, and that, you know, that just basically mean that there's permanently a lot of slack in the economy and wage growth remains quite low. So how do you think this is going to affect inflation? Do you think that's going to hold it back?
Well, historically, there's always been worries about new technologies wiping out jobs. So it makes sense to keep an open mind that this time is different. But it is worth remembering that all the way back to the Industrial Revolution, automation-related job losses in some sectors have boosted productivity and raised aggregate income, which has created new jobs in other sectors. And it's worth mentioning that there's been no growth in routine jobs for decades now. And this is the case with both cognitive routine jobs and manual routine jobs. All of the job growth has been in the non-routine categories. So automation has been taking place for a long time.
Okay. So look, there's a lot of different points to take in there. But assuming this is right, that the risks to inflation are maybe not imminent, but tilted to the upside eventually, I mean, what are the implications for investors? What should they be doing in response to that kind of outlook?
Yeah, well, so an underweight position in bonds makes sense. I mean, even in our base case, without an imminent inflation problem, bonds generally perform poorly as global growth picks up. And we also think it makes sense to have some precious metal exposure in portfolios. So in our base case, no inflation, imminent inflation problem outlook, gold will likely not go up a lot. But the real reason to hold gold is as a portfolio hedge. High inflation would have an adverse effect on both bonds and equities, but likely be good for gold. But we currently prefer silver actually over gold, given it has more leverage to a strengthening economy due to its wider industrial applications. And then finally, it makes sense to have some exposure to equity markets with high commodity sector exposure. And given rising inflation pushes up bond yields, it makes sense to have exposure to the sector most levered to rising yields right now, which is the financials and banks in particular. So from a regional perspective, equity markets like emerging markets, ex Asia and the UK have lots of commodities and financials.
Okay, all right. Well, look, Paul, that's been really useful. Thanks very much for taking us through that. Not always intuitive what the impact of these different factors is on the outlook for inflation. I know to a certain extent this is one of the main challenges confronting the School of Economics. But also thanks to our listeners. Hopefully you found this a useful discussion about inflation and what portfolios can do to guard against it. And hopefully you'll join us again as well in a future edition of the Bruin Podcast.